song. I don't think any of us knew that song except for Paige, at least coming in. But if you listen to the words of that song, if you hear the heart behind that song, you can still enter into that time of worship even without knowing it. And that's really this week, God's shown me multiple times that the heart of worship is far more important than the style of worship. You know, the music that I listen to worship and in my own quiet time may sound a little bit different, and that's okay. And the way that somebody leads music sometimes that may be different than maybe it sounds in the hymnal or we've grown up hearing it, and that's okay. And the beauty of that is all of that can still be pleasing worship to God. And so I've seen far too many churches fold and falter because of silly things like music style. And it's sad when you realize that all of it is pleasing and honorable worship to God. And, you know, if that becomes an issue, when that becomes an issue, then maybe we are worshiping our preferences a little bit more than we like to admit. So I know that's a tangent that has nothing to do with Joshua chapter 3, but God is really doing that. So Paige, thank you for leading worship for us. We're going to continue in our series in Joshua. We're going to be in Joshua chapter 3 this morning. And so if you remember last week, we talked about the story of Rahab and the spies and all that was getting situated as Israel is finally going to go into the land of promise, finally going to take what God has promised them almost 40 years before. And we see the beginnings of this take place. And so we saw the two spies, or the spies go into the city. We saw their interaction with Rahab, the pagan prostitute, and we see them come back. And so now in chapter 3, we pick up with they have returned. They have told Joshua what they've seen, and now God has given them the instructions to move forward. So if you'll join with me, Joshua chapter 3, we will read the entire chapter as we have to take the narrative as a whole to understand what's going on. Joshua chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Now Joshua rose early in the morning and set out from Shittim. And they came to the Jordan, and he and all of the people of Israel, and they lodged there before passing over. At the end of the 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, "As soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set out for your place and you shall follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way that you shall go, for you have passed this way before." Then Joshua said to all the people, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." Joshua then said to the priest, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass before the people." So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. Verse 7, the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all of Israel, so that they might know that as I was with Moses, so I will also be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant that when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan." So Joshua said to the people of Israel, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God." Joshua said, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the other ites, the Amorites, the Jebusites, all of the ites you could think of. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth. It is passing before you into the Jordan. Now there take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe, one man, and the soles of their feet of the priest shall bear the Ark of the Covenant, and the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap." So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan, with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the Ark of the Covenant came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the Ark were dipped into the brink of the water, now note the Jordan overflows and all of its banks throughout the time of harvest. The waters coming down from above stood up and rose up in a heap far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zereth. And those flowing down towards the Sea of Arabia, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant and the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all of the nation finished passing over the Jordan. Now, if you'll notice, there was a lot of redundancy. We hear a lot of the same things over and over, but the way is clear. God is telling Joshua what he is supposed to tell the people, and then the reason we see it be so redundant is we see that Joshua tells the people exactly what God told Joshua. That's the point that the author here is trying to make, is that the Lord gave very clear instructions. This is what you need to do, and Joshua, as a leader following after God, as a man who believed in God and trusted God, delivered those instructions verbatim as they were given to him. And because of that, Israel would begin really this journey. They've been on this journey for the last 40 or so years, but begin this journey into the land of promise that God had given them. And now if you look in the first couple verses, the first really two verses, we see they were camping by the Jordan River. And remember, this is the entire nation of Israel. This isn't just two spies. This isn't just a couple people. This is an entire nation of people that has upped their lives and upped where they have been for the last generation as they've been wandering in the wilderness and getting ready to move. And we see that there's a little bit of doubt in these first couple of verses by the people of Israel about what is about to happen. You see, they waited 3 days at the shore of the river. If you remember back in chapter 1, verse 11, God said, you are going to wait 3 days. I want you to wait at the Jordan, and then I will command you what to do. And so here we are where that is taking place. But they look before them. They see the rushing river that is the Jordan River, the barrier that is in front of them, and they say, how in the world are we going to pass through this? Now, if you remember Joshua's predecessor, Moses, he encountered something very similar with the people of Israel, looking at a body of water that were saying, how in the world are we going to get through this? And all those people were there for that. At least it's implied that they were there, or at least that they've heard the stories of that. And so here we are yet again in a very different situation with a different leader, a different body of water, but the same response is needed. You see, I talked about the whole idea of latitude and how we worship and how we've got some freedom there. Where we don't have latitude is in our obedience. Either we obey or we don't. Either we worship or we don't. And there was no latitude here. Either Israel was to obey what God had told them that they need to do, or they wouldn't. And that was the choice that they had to make. You see, it was one thing for two spies to cross over, right? If you remember, just in the very last chapter, the spies that went in to the city had to cross this river. But it's one thing for two people to cross the river. It's a whole other thing to get an entire nation across in this time. And so there was doubt. There was little uncertainty about what was to happen. I heard a story this week about a courtroom trial that was going on that sparked some uncertainty. So there was a murder trial that was coming to a close. Everything had been presented. All the evidence had been there. It was very overwhelming evidence against the defendant that was accused of murder. But the biggest defense of the defendant was that there was no body found. Sure, you could say there was a murder, but there was no body found. And so at the very end, the defense attorney knew that it was not going well. And so he threw out one last Hail Mary. And he gets up and he says, our best piece of evidence has yet to appear. And he says, in just a moment, the man that you think is dead will walk through these doors. And so he pauses and he waits. And after about a minute, nothing happened. And then the defense attorney gets back up and he says, okay, maybe I wasn't totally honest about that part. Maybe that's not actually going to take place, but you looked. You were waiting with anticipation. And the fact that you were waiting and looking with anticipation shows that maybe there's a sliver of doubt that he is actually dead. Not a bad play from a defense attorney, right? That's pretty good. So he went into the jury proceedings feeling great about it, right? But within minutes, the jury came to a decision. And he was feeling pretty good about it until the jury came back and said that they found the defendant guilty. And he was perplexed. He had no idea. He thought he just made the biggest play that he could have ever made. And he asked finally, he said, how? He said, why did you so quickly come to a decision? I saw you. I saw every single one of you look and wait at that door for that man to walk through. And the speaker said, well, we all did, right? That was good, and we all did. He said, but there was one mistake. The defendant was not looking at the door at all. The defendant knew that that man wasn't walking through, right? There was no doubt for him. There may have been doubt from everybody else. And so an interesting story, but the people of Israel here are showing doubt, right? There was a sliver of doubt, and they were showing that by their uncertainty of what they were about to do, what was about to happen. But the defendant in this case, and what we're reading today, was the God of Israel. There was no reason to have any doubt about what he was capable of. All they had to do was remember just years ago, just one generation before, when God led them out of captivity in Egypt that they had been enslaved to for so long. When they crossed a body of water much larger than the body of water that they were facing right now. There was no reason to doubt, yet there was still a sliver of doubt in that midst. You see, the irony is for years, 40 years wandering in the wilderness, they talked about what it would be like to finally enter the promised land, what that would look like, what that would be like. They dreamed of it, and the time had come, but there was an obstacle in the way, and all of a sudden there's just a little bit of doubt. Maybe you can identify with that just a little bit. Maybe you can identify knowing who it is that's in charge, who it is that has the game plan, that knows exactly how it's going to play out, but seeing an obstacle in front of us and saying, you know, maybe this isn't the way that we should do things. Maybe we can relate with Israel just a little bit. Individually, for certain, right? We've all faced those rivers, those rushing waters in life, those barriers for where we're trying to get to, and something stands in our way of that. Maybe we have felt that individually, but I think even corporately, we can feel that as well, right? It's easy for that to happen in churches too, right? Maybe we've got an idea of what the promised land looks like, where we want to be, where we want to go, what we want to look like. But the moment that a barrier comes in, and that barrier of uncertainty, that barrier of being a little bit uncomfortable, of doing things a little bit different is there, we pause and we say, you know, maybe, maybe not, maybe not. But you see, there is no reason to fear. There is no reason for doubt when we know who is in charge. When we have the person leading us, whether it be Moses, whether it be Joshua, all of them focused on God. So we know that who we are following is God himself. And if Moses can get an entire nation through the rushing waters of the Red Sea, and Joshua can get people through the rushing waters of the Jordan River, perhaps the God that they were following can get us through the rushing waters of whatever life is throwing our way. We see in the next section, the verses 3 through 5, we see the leaders in action, right? God has said, okay, this is what I need you to do. And we see the leaders deliver that information verbatim. Now notice that typically in conquest, right, this is what this was, an entire nation moving from one place to another to inhabit the land. You put your best foot forward when it comes to that as a show of strength. That was typical. That was kind of what was always done. And what did God ask Joshua to do? What was the foot forward that God asked Joshua to do? Priests with the Ark of the Covenant. Typically in military warfare, you put your most courageous, fearful, whatever you have to strike the fear into your enemy first, so that that's what they see. Yet God says, first, I want the priest and I want the Ark of the Covenant. And we'll talk a little bit more about the significance of that. But the representation of God himself, of the very presence of God being the Ark of the Covenant, that was what was to lead Israel. That was their best foot forward and what they were about to do. And Joshua knew this, right? Joshua knew that what was about to happen was much more a spiritual battle than a physical battle that they were going to endure, because God had already promised he was going to deliver them through their enemies. And so he didn't have to worry about how his army was configured or what the battle plan was, because the battle plan was follow what God said to do. And then even more so, God required that they keep about, it says 2,000 cubits, maybe about 1,000 yards behind the Ark of the Covenant, which is also a strange request when marching into battle. Because typically, your whole army sticks together so that the sheer number of that strikes the fear into people. But here, God asks the rest of the people to fall behind. And we might ask why. And some of those reasons might include just the simple respect to the holy nature of the Ark of the Covenant, right? The Ark of the Covenant represented the very presence of God. And so there was a respect that it is on in a level, in a playing field of its own, right? And so it needed its own, it needed to be by itself, to be by its own. But also, it was to make sure that the Ark could always be seen by the entire nation of Israel. As they're marching to what is to come, instead of what is in their eyesight with the Ark being in front of them, what is always directly in front of them is the Ark of the Covenant, the very presence of God. They shouldn't be focused on the Battle of Jericho that's coming. They shouldn't be focused on any of that else around them. What they should be focused on is what's right in front of them, and what's right in front of them is the presence of God. You see, Israel would only accomplish what was about to take place, the feats that were in front of them, with their eyes fixed on the God of Israel. So again, perhaps we can relate to that this morning. Perhaps you're facing an insurmountable task to enter whatever the promised land of life looks like for you at this moment. You see where you want to go, you know where you want to be, but there is something in the way. And perhaps the only way to make it through is to keep your eyes on the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. The very presence of God that goes before is where we should keep our eyes. Their way to make it through was to keep their eyes on God. And for you and for me today, whatever it is in life that we're facing, whatever the difficulty is, whatever the rushing waters look like, the way to make it through is to keep our eyes focused on the Lord. You see, Joshua called people in these verses to sanctify themselves. So the version I read says consecrate themselves, to prepare themselves for what is to come. Because if they're going to be in the very presence of God, they need to be prepared for what is to come. You see, everybody had a part to play. This wasn't, all right, as long as the priests do their thing, you guys are going to be good. Or as long as the warriors did their thing, you guys are going to be good. Every single person had a part to play in what was about to take place. Now the question would be, would they take it seriously? Would they play their part? Would they do what God had asked them to do? And that's something we need to ask ourselves as well, because we've talked about this divine mission for a long time since I've been here. This mission that we have to go and to bring the good news of Jesus to people. And we all have a part to play. And the question we need to ask ourselves is, are we going to take it seriously? Are we going to do that? And then in verse 6, we see Joshua take the step of faith and telling the priests, all right, the time has come. We're going to do it the way that God said to do it. He put his faith into action. He actually did what God asked, and we'll dig into that here in just a second. But can the same be said for us when the time comes? They've been talking about it for 40 years. They're standing in the midst of an obstacle. They know what's ahead, and God said, all right, it's time. I need you to trust me. Joshua, without hesitation, did it. He saw his predecessor, Moses, without hesitation, do it. Is that something that we are prepared to do when God tells us, hey, I've called you to this, I've prepared you for this, it's time. It's time to act. Will we be ready? You know, some of us, and I'll just say me, but I venture there may be some more of us in here. Anybody else directionally challenged, or is it just me? Okay, there's one. Okay, I see a couple hands, a few. All right, there's some of us that are the instructions. I see some people pointing to others too, so just beware of that. So there are some of us, myself, and I'm mainly speaking to myself here. If you identify, I appreciate it, that even sometimes the clear directions don't work as well, right? So for me, a lifeline that I don't understand how you guys survived without before is a GPS. I promise, especially getting around like Westlake and stuff. I mean, that train stops and I got to peel off the road. I need the GPS to figure out where I'm going to be. But think about it for a second. When I enter in whatever the intended destination is, right, the GPS plots a straight route, okay? And if I trust that plan, and I simply just follow the blue line, mine's blue, I know that I'll get where I need to go eventually, right? And even when I deviate from that plan, the beauty of a GPS is it redirects us, right? I get off that blue line, I go somewhere different because I'm crazy. it figures it out most of the time. Sometimes it just says, you're on your own, I give up. But it redirects and plots your course again, right? And we don't have to fret when we get off course because I know that it's going to redirect me, and I know, again, if I just follow the plan, I'll get there eventually. If we're so quick to trust our maps, our GPSs, our apps, whatever it may be, to get us where we need to go, to follow the intended plan, then why is it so hard for us to trust the God of the universe and his plan for our lives, the one who created us, the one who created everything around us? It is so difficult for us to trust that plan because it might look a little different and might feel a little more uncomfortable than we would expect. See, God laid out the plan, right? The blue line was there, and it led straight through the Jordan River, right? And if that's where the plan leads, then there's going to be a way. God will provide a way through that. And all they had to do was trust in the plan, follow the blue line, follow the steps, and they would get where they were intended to be. And in verses 7 and 8, God encourages Joshua. Joshua delivers this plan. They're going to do what they're supposed to do. And God encourages Joshua that if you follow through, this is what I want from you. And verse 7, it's one of my favorite parts of this whole chapter. God tells Joshua, as I was with Moses, I will also be with you. I mean, God is saying here, look, you have seen what I did when Moses was in charge and following my game plan. You've seen what took place when you and your entire nation were led out of captivity of Egypt that had you for generations. You saw what took place when Moses led you through the Red Sea. As I will be with Moses, I will also be with you. God's simply saying, if you stick with me, I'll use you just like I used Moses to bring glory and honor to my name. And just like Moses, Joshua's going to lead the nation through